back to the Four Idle Hands podcast. Terry, it's almost our third birthday. Will be our third birthday by the time this goes out, I suppose.
So Facebook told me today, which today is the 8th of February, isn't it? It is the 8th of February.
Yeah.
So today is the Four Idle Hands birthday, and for some reason, we're 103 years old.
Yeah, well, that was me. I set it up, and then I handed it over to you. So
so then I thought the 103 must be symbolic to something. There must be some reason for that.
It's not.
So, and tomorrow, which is the 9th of February, which I'll hopefully get this episode uploaded, will be the 3 years exactly from we did the first one.
Yeah, and it's also our 40th episode.
Yes.
Imagine that.
Which is quite bad. I looked at that today and I thought that's quite funny, actually. So it's quite a good sort of symbolic sort of time to get back on the wagon, so to speak.
Yeah, it shows just how prolific we were at times. I mean, we haven't been very prolific recently. I think it's our first one since the infamous Anvil podcast. Well,
that was good. So, interesting enough, on the Anvil one, that's been a very popular episode. And because the hosting people we use, which they keep giving me stats every day, which are only stats from their website. But the Anvil one, people have listened to that there's almost been someone listening to it every day since we did it.
Excellent.
Because they played the night we interviewed them, they were playing the Anvil. Anvil were playing the Anvil in Bournemouth.
Yes.
Yes. And I met a guy last week who'd been to the gig in Aberdeen, and he obviously enjoyed it and said they seemed particularly grumpy when they came on stage.
Imagine that.
But they played their gig and then they stayed around for ages to do photographs and have drinks and stuff after the gig. So it was very good. So
fabulous. Well, we've got a whole load of stuff to talk about on this episode. We don't have a guest as such, so it's me and you as the guests, really, Terry.
Yes.
So we're going to take a wee trip down memory lane with a couple of things that happened 40 and 45 years ago, which include the release of Def Leppard's Pyromania album in 1983. And myself and yourself saw them at the start of that tour, so we'll talk about that in a second. And it's also 45 years next week since Kate Bush's The Kick Inside was released in 1978.
Yeah.
Not your favourite album.
It's not. And I feel bad because I know Kate Bush, we'll come to it, but Kate Bush is obviously very popular. So I think it's me. It's just me. It's not her, it's me. So I've got better suggestions from 1978.
Right. Okay. Well, we look forward to hearing those in due course. There's obviously been quite a lot happening in the world of football. Six Nations Rugby has kicked off, so we'll be talking about that. And, you know, we've got some other kind of nostalgic stuff. We've got Thin Lizzy's Live and Dangerous box set was released a couple of weeks ago. Secretary going to review that. And we've got the horrendous thought of you two plundering their back catalogue with Songs of Surrender, which will be out before too long. So we'll chew the fat over what we've heard so far on that. We've also both been to see James Yorkston and Nina Persson and the Second Hand Orchestra, so we'll talk about that. Terry's going to review Gaz Coombs' new album, Turn the Car Around, and also a couple of movies, All Quiet on the Western Front and Tar. Yeah. So, Terry, let's go back 40 years ago this week. Def Leppard kicked off their Pyromania tour with second, third dates were Dublin, Belfast, and we were there separately. Obviously, yeah. Didn't know each other at that stage. You have any abiding memories of that gig?
I can remember being very excited when I heard Photograph. That's one of my favourite songs. I do love that song. But what I can remember about it was that I don't think the sound was great. I was talking to a friend today who'd also been to the same concert with me, and I can't remember an awful lot. You sent me the set list, which was I do kind of remember roughly what order they did the stuff in. Rock of Ages sounded terrible, I remember. Because that was one, I think it was that kind of start, but it just sounded awful. But I remember coming out of that thinking that was a fantastic record, and these were going to be, from their previous albums, which have been okay, I think everyone kind of thought this was going to be it, and it obviously was for them. So, we got backstage in Belfast, but I don't remember much about it. So,
how did you manage that?
We just walked around the back of Ulster Hall, which is quite a common thing. And occasionally they would let you in. And you got into the dressing room, which was not very celebrity. It wasn't very fancy or anything. And I remember that we did the same with Michael Schenker, and he was sitting on one of these black plastic like school chairs, and he just signed your autograph on your jacket or if you had a record or whatever. And that was it. But Def Leppard, we got in, and there was an awful lot of people, I remember, thinking in the dress. It was quite small. It was almost like a school football pitch dressing room. It wasn't very nice. And we just got in. We didn't even have a girl with us. It was just like three or four blokes, and they let us in. I think we got our denim jacket signed, and that was it, really. So
fabulous. Well, I was up the front with my brother and a couple of others, and I was standing directly in front of Phil Collin, who'd obviously just joined the band at that stage. And he gave me his plectrum, which was an odd thing because it was made from stainless steel. And I would have it today, but for the fact my mother threw it out probably about 39 years ago.
Okay, well, that's cool.
Yeah. Well, still haven't forgiven her.
That's quite cool. My other Def Leppard story, it really is when I was at uni, the band, and I think you've seen this band, the big band in Belfast at the time was Sweet Savage,
mm-hmm.
which was Vivian Campbell. And Vivian Campbell used to hang about our uni with my cousin, who's a year or two older than me. And we used to hang about with, who was the singer guy, the bass player?
Ramey Waller.
Ramey, that's right. Yeah, Vivian Campbell. And so then, of course, Vivian Campbell headed off to do his deal first, I think.
Yep.
Yep. Got booed off the stage. Well, didn't get booed off the stage, but got booed at the Antrim Forum because he was a bit too much of a poser, and then turned up at Def Leppard. But he's quite a nice lad, though. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, looking back to that set list, it was mainly stuff from High and Dry and Pyromania. So they did one cover, which was Traveling Band, right at the end. I mean, my memories of it was really that, I think the sound was quite good. I saw them in a smaller venue, which was Eamon Andrews TV Club in on Harker Street in Dublin. And the sound was good. And I just thought, and I mean, didn't have much experience of going to big bands at that stage, but I did think they were going to be huge because the way they carried themselves on stage, they had a lot of attitude.
Yeah.
And obviously there were some, you know, great pop songs in on Pyromania. Looking back on it, the production of that album sounds really of its time now, doesn't it? It's quite tinny.
It does. And you go into that to Hysteria, which is high production sort of values. It's very much chalk and cheese. But you see, I listened to a live recording of them recently and they sounded pretty good. And of course they are doing their big summer tour this year with the Motley Crue, and you could meet them for £1,000.
Yeah, they found great value. And did you know who was hauled in to tart up some of the tracks, the atmospherics on some of the tracks on Pyromania? He's credited as Booker T. Boffin, and he's the guy that plays keyboards and other probably early kind of sequencers and things like that. None other than Thomas Dolby of She Blinded Me with Science and Hyperactive fame.
He must be working at the studio, wherever it was at the time, I guess. Or would they just have been...
Yeah, I think they just brought him in, paid him lots of money to do it, so...
Oh, well, that was good. No, it's only still one of my favourite albums. I had listened to it last week, I think, so... that was good. Enjoyed it. Also, Hall was quite a big venue, mind you. Maybe that's why it was a bit tinny, actually. So.
Okay, so we're going to take you... you're going to have to get back into the DeLorean and recalibrate it for 1978 now, Terry. And on the 17th of February, Kate Bush's first album, The Kick Inside, was released. And apparently she'd been working on it for years, but they'd been in the studio on and off for about 2 years recording that album. Some of the songs she'd written when she was only 13.
Wow.
Get a load of that.
I mean, my memories of this, and apologies to Kate Bush fans, because I know people are very fanatical about Bush, but I didn't, the Wuthering Heights single, I didn't like it at all. I just couldn't be done with that on the hillside. It was a bit like sort of Sound of Music, Run Around the Hill. And I mean, obviously, Hounds of Love later on stuff. Yes, I got into that, but this one, this wasn't for me at all. And I know, people will listen to it tomorrow. I think it's tomorrow. I think this week, Six Music are doing Kicking Aside Day. They're doing the 45 years, but I decided to go back to 1978 and find some better songs to listen to.
Right, but before you do that, the story of Kate Bush is pretty amazing. She was spotted by Well, David Gilmour, amongst others, who put together the crew to record that album in the studio. And she was signed to EMI at a very young age indeed. It's an album that she probably wouldn't listen to herself. Apparently, she doesn't like the sound of her voice from those years. And obviously, these are songs that she just wouldn't play, or indeed, they rarely feature in anything in the way of licensing or compilation albums or things like that. So she's kind of turned her back on it, pretty much like you have, Terry. So what do you prefer from 1978?
So my playlist, right? I'll give you just a few headlines. There's quite a lot on here. So I've got Roxanne by The Police.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Walsh, Life's Been Good, obviously the Eagles. I've got Cheap Trick, I Want You to Want Me from Live at Budokan. Toto, I'm going to forget that one. I've got Shattered, the Rolling Stones, which was the album, I can't remember the albums. Was it Some Girls? Want to Be Sedated by the Ramones, Lots of Foreigner. Oh, and much better album, Darkness on the Edge of Town by Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, it was Van Halen won in 1978 as well.
I'm not sure if this, I did wonder if this was US or UK releases. I suddenly thought of that afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. Possibly was. And if it wasn't Van Halen 1, it would be Van Halen 2. So yeah, great time for music. Atlantis Tamura was the first album I ever bought with my own money, like on vinyl. So, yeah, still got it somewhere, played through to the other side, I think.
Well, I played this playlist to my son this morning, and he was quite unbelievable that some of the songs were from 1978, because all those particular songs all sound pretty fresh today, actually. So.
Yeah. Now, something else, I'm going to skip forward a wee bit, well, same year, but something else that came out in 1978 was the magnum opus that is Thin Lizzy's Live and Dangerous.
Yes. So,
and it stayed at the top of the charts, held off by, I think, Grease, was it, in 1978? Or Saturday Night Fever, it was one or the other, for an eternity. So it never made number one. Might have made number one with this reissue, has it?
I don't know. I'm going to check if they've made any charts. I don't know. Do they do CD charts now? I'm not sure they do.
Well, I mean, I think it would be a big seller. For those who haven't heard about it, it's an 8-CD box set, which features all of the live sets that were used for, well, basically that they called Live and Dangerous from, and also includes the sound from the Rainbow Theatre gig that they recorded for video release. A year or two later, wasn't it?
It's so comprehensive. I mean, you've got sort of three nights at Hammersmith, then you've got the Tower. Well, what I like, actually, I like the Tower Theatre Philadelphia one. I do love Soldier of Fortune, actually. I mean, that didn't make the original, the final cut, did it, at all? But it's a song I do like, Thin Lizzy.
The Tower Theatre Philadelphia set, that has been released before. That was out on an album called Still Dangerous.
That's
probably
right.
Came out about 10 years ago. So the stuff that we hadn't heard before was really those other Hammersmith efforts from the three nights that obviously, you know, we only heard a chunk of that before. And the Toronto gig, I think, was the other one.
Yeah, but as a box set, I mean, I wasn't sure how it would look. I was kind of expecting it to be sort of a CD cover size, but actually it's almost like a 10-inch single. There's sort of one book with all the CDs and then one book with lots of photographs and sort of promotional material. So as a Thin Lizzy sort of collector's item, it's certainly, I mean, I think it's definitely worth the money. I've spoken to a lot of people who've bought it and certainly very impressed. The sound, has it been enhanced at all, you think? It's hard to tell.
Well, I listened to it in the shop on a very high-end system they got in there, and I thought it just sounded fantastic. I mean, the album has been kind of, you know, there's always been this question mark over how much of it was live. You know, Tony Visconti probably was the source of a lot of that in terms of saying that, you know, Lynott initially wanted to cover up the odd bum note that he played on bass, or, you know, that he wasn't happy with some of the backing vocals. And then that it went from there on to the guitarist wanting to tidy various bits up as well. But, you know, if you listen to these individual nights worth of sets, there's no doubt that, you know, it was really just polishing it up was what Visconti did, and I think it's a nonsense to say that album was kind of recorded in the studio.
Well, I think so. And I went back and listened to, actually, this is it before, I listened to a bunch of other kind of, because live albums are not really, I mean, people do release live stuff, I guess, but it's not as sort of popular as it used to be. And some of the ones I listened to just at sort of the last sort of couple of weeks was this, the UFO, Strangers in Time, which is a great album.
Strangers in the Night.
In the Night, sorry. I took my glasses off for a second. I listened to Johnny Cash, sort of San Quinn, which was obviously live. Your favorite one will be U2, Under a Blood Red Sky. Cheap Trick at Budokan, which again is one of my favorite ones. I love that one. And I had the Bob Seger 99 and Iron Maiden Life After Death, which was good. So, but it certainly stands the test of time. And yeah, listen to it again. It always sounds like a breath of fresh air to me, actually. So.
Yeah. And the other thing I would say about listening to these other bits that we hadn't heard before is, it's reinforced time and again what a brilliant frontman Lynott was. I mean, the patter between the songs, the interaction with the crowd, just terrific.
Yeah, it was very good. Have you ever been to, is it Dublin? It was a Thin Lizzy Museum. Is it Dublin?
Nope.
I saw somebody this week had been to the Thin Lizzy Museum. Now, where was that? And it looked a bit crap. That's the honest answer. But apparently, the only thing that looked pretty good was they had Phil's guitar with the silver thing on it. But they had like flight cases for guitars, which were empty, which was a bit strange. I need to look back where it was, but I thought if anywhere there should be one, there should be one in Dublin. But
they did have an exhibition probably about 10 or 15 years ago at the top of Stephen's Green in the shopping mall up there. And it was very good because they'd obviously, borrowed a lot of things from the likes of Jim Fitzpatrick, who did a lot of the artwork for the Lizzy albums, the early ones anyway. And stuff from Phil's mum, and that was good because it gave you real insight into the band's early years, and there were lots of things that I never saw before at that, and there were guitars and things. So this sounds like a really bad effort.
But you'll be queuing up to join whenever they do finish the U2 Land or whatever it's called. Then are they?
Yeah, well, it's not going anywhere fast at the moment, Terry. So as you know, they have a patch of land not far from the O2 arena, is that what they call it now, which used to be the Point Depot. So it's down there just on the banks of the Liffey, and it's supposed to be an immersive U2 experience, which I'm assuming it's going to be quite expensive to get into.
I don't think so.
Yeah, so well,
it's the tree arena, by the way, now it's called
O3 Arena. Got the wrong sponsor.
But it's funny, so I know I digress a bit, but I was booking tickets to go to Dublin in September to see the National. I thought that'd be a good place to go and see them. And of course, you can do a tour of the new Windmill Lane studios that they built after they knocked down the old ones. Interesting enough, they don't really, they kind of make it that it's the original one, even though it was built years afterwards, and we went down to the original one last time we were in Dublin, and it's gone. The whole street is gone, and all that kind of graffiti they had is all gone as well. So it's a bit of a shame. But it was the new one, Def Leppard, did record in there, apparently. So I don't know which bits they recorded. But so we're going to go do a tour of that, apparently. So.
Yeah. And staying with you two, they have got something coming fairly shortly on Paddy's Day. We have the much vaunted appearance of Songs of Surrender. And what I say about this, Terry, is I surrender. I'm going to raise the white flag. I just don't think I want to hear any more of this. Tell me what you think of what you heard so far.
So I'm not a fan of what I've heard so far. I think they obviously recorded it. So there's a couple of things on the go. So obviously Larry can't play at the minute. Apparently he's got some sort of back injury or spasm. So he's unable to play this year at all. So they can't. I think they plan to do some live gigs, and maybe they plan to do some more, something a bit more upbeat. But I guess they've changed this around now. They've decided to do this song, which was Bono's book. I mean, it's not like a band autobiography. It's his book, 40 songs, 40, the life of U2. And they've now done an album of all the songs, and they re-recorded them, kind of stripped down would be the best way to describe it. And I don't think they work so well. It's a bit, yeah, I don't know, him on the edge. I mean, they must have been really bored.
Yeah, I mean, the version of With or Without You there is, it's kind of meandering, plodding. It sounds to me almost like there had been a power cut and that they maybe had a tape deck, battery powered tape deck, and they went up to Edge's bedroom and recorded this to keep themselves amused.
Yeah, I mean, I like you too, but I went online to their website to order. There was a, I can't remember the color of the vinyl, four vinyls. There's different versions, of course. So there's like a double album and there's a quadruple album, I think, which is all 40 songs. And they were sold out so quickly. I saw, in fact, one of your customers, I forget who it was, had bought green and red or red and green or purple, different colored vinyls. And they all, day one, they all sold out. So obviously there's demand for it. But yeah, I don't think it's one. I'll probably listen to it for sure, but I don't think it's going to be a classic.
Yeah, and it is expensive. I mean, the vinyl version of it's probably not far off £40 per go. So
yeah,
you know, if you're a diehard fan, you're going to be really out of pocket pretty badly with this one.
I think so. I know, unfortunately, I hate to say it, but they probably will tour these at some point this year. They'll probably do a little sort of... I mean, it's not quite going to be... It's not going to probably be Murrayfield with Beyonce tickets, by the way, but so...
They could maybe do it as a kind of carbon neutral one because they don't need to plug anything in for this. It's just the Hedge with his acoustic guitar, Bono shouting, and nobody going to it. So there's no carbon to offset.
Well, I'm surprised they haven't figured out to do what ABBA did with just build a wee place and call it Bono Tars or something and have him and the Edge sort of just playing every night the same sort of stuff. But yeah, I think I'm not quite sure how it's going to end up, I think, but yeah.
Okay, well, we've got that to look forward to and to eviscerate when the time comes. Speaking of eviscerations, Aberdeen have lost another manager, Terry. This is Jim Goodwin has gone after not very long, really. Any thoughts on Aberdeen Football Club?
You have to be really careful here. So I think it was time. I think Jim Goodwin probably had to go. I don't know enough. I do go to Aberdeen. I'd watch them certainly and follow this so on. But this whole thing about they lost the dressing room. I think the players have lost the plot, which maybe was him, an experienced manager. Aberdeen's got a lot of expectations to be successful. And they were doing okay, actually, up until the World Cup. And it was the post-World Cup results where they had a couple of 5-0, 6-0 drubbings. They lost to Darvel, which is a non-league team in the Scottish Cup, which was an absolutely terrible performance. Then they lost at home to St Mirren, which wasn't great. And then, thankfully, last weekend, they managed to beat Motherwell, who were second bottom fairly comfortably. So hopefully, Barry Robson will steady the ship. But I think, I think Goodwin was a bit of an experiment that didn't work.
Yeah.
I think he was a data guy, you know, all this kind of money ball sort of thing. And because I think the players are capable of winning games, but just the organization wasn't great. And Goodwin, I don't know if you saw the video at the end where he sort of walked across the pitch and jumped the turnstile into the car park and his wife picked him up and he drove home and didn't even go back in the bus. I missed that. I'd like to say that, but I thought that was quite classy of him, actually. He didn't even do the post-match interview. Off he went and that was it. So,
yeah. And we've got a lot of football club owners have got
Do you follow League Two, Michael? Because that could be where Man City are heading.
Yeah, indeed. we'll get on to that in a second. But I was just going to say that football club owners have got no patience these days. I mean, you got Frank Lampard Jr. He got the bullet. Jesse Marsh, Leeds manager, he's gone as well. So, these guys are desperate to make sure that they stay in the Moneyball game, as you say. And City, obviously, have been caught on the naughty step again, this time with the English Premier League. And they've got to answer 100 counts of various types of infringements on financial fair play.
But if you read the 100, okay, there's a lot of stuff in there, but some of them are like, it was like 20 that just didn't answer emails, apparently. They didn't reply to requests. So it's not, okay, that's fair enough. And apparently Manchester City's lawyer, I read today, was £80,000 a day, which seems ridiculous. So anybody would be charging that much money. And I'm pretty sure they're not the only one. If they look into all these teams, Chelsea got in trouble because they were giving these like 8-year contracts. So they were paying a fortune. It was like Ukrainian lad for him and then putting his contract over 8 years. So it divides up. So it waters down the cash and it's all very murky, I think. So,
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, football is pretty murky. Anytime you've got lots of money washing around, you'll have people with looking after number one, really, one way or the other. And your beloved Manchester United apparently are attracting the interest of the Emir of Qatar.
What a wonderful guy he is as well. Like, I mean, break it on. I mean, but he's the guy who owns Paris Saint-Germain as well, apparently.
Yeah. And no doubt there'll be all sorts of shenanigans there with players being loaned across the two clubs. Oh, there's a lot to look forward to, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And I think the Man City things, as someone said there at work today, that it's just going to drool on for the rest of the season. It may affect the team, though. That's the only thing. It'll end up with a fine, maybe a points deduction, but it'll keep them in the Champions League. It'll keep them, you know, they're not going to drop these big teams out of the league, you know.
Yeah, and I think on the English Premier League's side, it's an attempt to avoid further oversight by the government to want them to clean up the act. And you know, City's the club that, you know, they're an easy one to pick on. You know, after Chelsea over the last couple of years with Abramovich, but City are the next target, aren't they?
Yeah, and I'm sure. Well, actually, I think the next target would be Newcastle. I'm pretty sure there'd be somebody outside St James's Park going open their books up a little bit. So once they've let them, I mean, they've done that a full year. A full year at the Saudis, maybe they have, but. That could be interesting as well. So,
yeah, a lot to look forward to there. And we've just had the first weekend of Rugby Six Nations. Always a little hint of spring in the air for this, Terry. A little bit more light round. Saw a couple of snowdrops in the garden the other day. And just to cap it off with fantastic wins for Scotland and Wales, and Ireland. What I'm talking about, Wales, Scotland and Ireland, and you know, Italy can count themselves very unlucky not to have overturned France. So, what did you make of the three games?
I thought the Ireland game was predictable. Ireland were very good in the first half, and then kind of just got a bit bored at halftime and came out and didn't do very much. Wales scored, and then that was kind of it. They played for 30 minutes and thought we better score again. So, which worries me that Ireland have this kind of often they'll start fast and then just kind of drift off. Scotland England game was like an old fashioned game, back and forward, lots of good tries. Scotland were very good. I thought England were pretty poor and didn't really show much. I mean, they could have gone either way for a bit, but Scotland showed a bit more adventure. Obviously, they are there. Scots, Johan, okay, I'm not gonna, he's obviously not Scottish.
Van der Merwe,
yeah, but Ireland can't throw that back in Scotland's face because they've got loads of South Africans and New Zealanders, etc., in their team as well. But no, I thought Scotland played really well and set up a nice game against Wales at the weekend. So
they certainly have. Scotland never really looked in major trouble in that match, did they? I know England were in the lead at one point, but Scotland were definitely the more dangerous team.
Yeah, they always looked like they're going to score again. And I saw somebody was talking about afterwards, and it was all about the speed between getting the ball from the ruck and getting it out wide, and England just couldn't cope with that speed, which does worry me that Ireland actually did look a bit laboured at times. Though there was some injuries. Jameson Gibson-Park didn't play, and they brought back in Conor Murray, who actually did all right, but I think I just worry that sometimes Ireland believe their own press a bit too much.
Yeah,
I think they could walk it. I mean, James Lowe's try from the halfway line was fantastic, but I think they need to do more of that.
Yeah, and you know, the two teams that lost in these kind of headline games, Wales and England, have got their age profile of the squads is tipping a bit over into the late 20s, early 30s, isn't it? And these look like squads that need to be overhauled big style.
Well, yeah, I mean, Wales had a terrible autumn losing, you know, they lost to Georgia and they didn't do very well at all. And England, not great, hence they changed the manager. But I mean, England play Italy this weekend, so they should win. They're at home. Wales, Scotland, I think Scotland could absolutely trounce Wales this weekend at Murrayfield with a big home support behind them. There'll be a lot of Wales fans as well, but I think Scotland have their tails up and they look quite adventurous. I think we saw Finn Russell's picture with all the team at the end with the Calcutta Cup, which was quite funny. So, but he didn't play particularly well, I don't think. I don't think he did. He sliced a couple of kicks and stuff, but I think, as someone said at the paper, Scotland, if not now, when?
There is an element of that, isn't there? They've got they'll have Ireland at home as well. So I think if they get the win against Wales, I think it will be a major shot in the arm for them. I would expect them to beat Wales.
Yeah, and looking forward, they said there's three teams in the top five in the same group in the World Cup: South Africa, Ireland, and Scotland now. So that could be, yeah, I do worry about that. And again, Scotland are playing Ireland and Murrayfield on the 12th of March, so that does worry me that game out. So that's.
Yeah, and Italy. We spoke to Willie Anderson last
Yeah.
year about Italy, and
He was right.
he's been proved right about these
Yeah.
young players coming through. They looked an utterly different team in the last 18 months, haven't
Yeah.
they?
They just really ran everything. Every time they got the ball, even on their own 22, they were running that ball out. They didn't kick it too much. I mean, they got a couple of kicks early on, which were blocked, which was pretty poor. But no, I mean, again, Italians, I say Italians in inverted commas, there's a few non-Italians in there, but that's fine. They were, yeah, they took it to France. Unbelievable. I thought they were going to do it at the end, actually. So very unlucky. But no, a good young team, I think, and they could cause some trouble. They'll certainly beat, I think they could beat Wales. And they could give, yeah, could give England. That'd be fun on Sunday, I think.
I think they will give England quite a game, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if they beat them. Lansdowne Road, Ireland against France, the big match of the kicks off the weekend. Terry, how are you feeling about that? Are you confident?
Yes, I think so. I think Ireland will be quite. I mean, France have got a win. I mean, people saying that's the tournament decider. I don't think it is this year. I think it's going to be everyone's going to be able to beat everybody else, I think. I think Ireland will win. It'll be closer than the Wales game. It'll be 10 or 12 points, but I think Ireland will win at home. Yeah, absolutely.
I think, like all games, it'll be one up front, and I think our pack's looking pretty good at the moment. I know we've got a couple of injuries, but
Yeah.
we've got the ball carriers, and the rucking is
Yeah.
top notch. Paul O'Connell's done a fantastic job with the forwards, and
Absolutely.
also the line out is good as well. In previous years, we've had at least one of the set pieces has misfired.
Yeah.
This year, they're looking good at the moment.
Pretty
So.
solid. And it was so nice to see Warren Gatland look miserable at the end, by the way.
Yeah, fabulous altogether. What isn't so fabulous, Terry, is the cost of going to these games now. Now, you told me about attempts to buy tickets for the was it the Scotland Ireland game or the Scotland Wales one?
So
And horrendous amounts of money.
I've got a season ticket for Murrayfield this year. So basically, for the season ticket, you get the autumn international games, then you get kind of the Six Nations. So this year is the more expensive one because there was three home games in the Six Nations, and there was four games actually in the autumn. So it's not bad actually. I think that ticket this year was 400 quid, but I think if you bought an individual ticket, so where my seats are, I think an individual it's a silver ticket. You're about 80 quid for a game, but it's gone upwards. And I know somebody went down to the Twickenham game, and they paid over 140 quid or something for a ticket, which is getting like Beyonce levels of tickets now. So it's very, very expensive, I think. So,
But you did say that corporate tickets
oh God, oh.
are crazy money.
Yeah, I think in Murrayfield, your corporate ticket now, your cheapest one this weekend would be. So 600. They do it'll, the Wales game. Funny enough, it's not as expensive as the Ireland game, because obviously the Irish can spend more money, I guess, or it's a bigger game. But you're talking 600-700 quid.
Yeah.
It's not cheap at all. And I think someone told me the corporate at Lansdowne Road or the Aviva was up there with that as well, probably in euros. But still, yeah, not a cheap day out there.
Yeah, you're better off just sitting at home with your feet kicked up and a draft Guinness can beside you.
Well, I'm going to be. We'll go to try and get to Murrayfield early enough to watch the Ireland game on their wee big screen outside. So hopefully, it's not going to be. I think it is dry, actually. And then we'll go in and watch the Wiggles game afterwards. So.
Great. Okay, right, that's enough sport. Also this week, Terry, we've got a couple of albums to talk about. We've already talked about the Thin Lizzy one. Gaz Coombs' new album. Turn the Car Around, the ex-Supergrass guy. I don't even know if they've actually really broken up, have they? They kind of turn up every now and again for a reunion.
No, I wasn't sure either. And they're quite pleasant to listen to, Supergrass. I've never really followed them ma madly, but I did listen. I just downloaded it. Listen, I didn't listen, didn't buy a vinyl copy, but I really enjoyed this record actually. And I apologize to you, I lost my notes. Which I wrote earlier. What would you like to search for? Oh, shut up, not you. That was my phone telling me that I've lost
called, them. It's called Turn the Car Around.
That, it is Turn the Car Around, but it reminds me very much like an Arctic Monkeys album.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think that's the... And I listened to it first through. I mean, it's quite... Nothing really kind of kicks in the gear like the Supergrass stuff does, but I thought excellent album. I'd quite like to see him play live as well. And I've dived back into his previous sort of solo stuff as well. And it's, yeah, it's excellent. So.
Yeah, I mean, his previous solo album's been pretty good. The Guardian have called this one the genuine English rocker's best album in 20 years.
Yeah, I think it's...
So it must be good. I've not heard it apart from just one track of it, so...
Yeah, I listened to that, and I know we didn't have it on our list. The other one I listened to was The Murder Capital, Gigi's thing, which I didn't like that album particularly. The song I heard I liked, and then I listened to the whole thing, and I thought, actually, maybe not. That's a bit overrated, that album, actually, so... I don't know if you've got to listen to it or not, but
I've heard a bit of it. Yeah, I know what you mean. It's not it's not as good as for example Fontaine's DC Skinty Fia. It's not got the same.
No, and the sort of headline song that I heard reminded me of that. I thought, oh, this is be good, and I went back in because they had a did they have a Record Store Day release last year?
Was it a live it's probably 2 or 3 years ago. It was a wee EP thing, yeah.
Yeah, I listened to that, and that was good. But this one, I thought, this is maybe a bit overrated. And I spoke to a couple of pals in Ireland about it, and they said, yeah, same thing. It's on the radio all the time, on RTE and Radio Ulster. They're just pushing them hard this year. But I think people, the reality wasn't quite as good. But yeah, certainly Gaz Coombs, I've really enjoyed listening to that, actually. So.
Good. Okay, and we've both been this week to see James Yorkston and the Second Hand Orchestra, complete with the Cardigans' Nina Persson on vocals. You saw the gig at the Lemon Tree, Terry, I saw down in Edinburgh. Your thoughts, please?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, I was a bit anxious, to be honest. I wasn't sure. I quite liked the records he's released the last two. We came along a bit late getting in, actually. And the girl, Amy May Ellis, the support act, was halfway through. But she was very good as well. She did that, something I'd never seen before in a gig. She did a live auction for some cash, which was funny. It was a good laugh. But James Yorkston was tremendous. I thought I really enjoyed it, actually. So. And I hadn't paid attention to the band beforehand. So the fact that the guitarist was from Peter, Bjorn and John.
Yeah.
Swedish song. Can you whistle it? I can't. There we go.
Something like that, yeah.
And then, did he say a bit about the bass player in Mamma Mia? I couldn't remember what you said.
Well, I think the bass player was co-producer of the album and so was the drummer.
Yeah. But he'd been something, he'd played or done the bass bit on Mamma Mia or something, I'm pretty sure he said.
Okay.
So, but no, I thought it was great. I thought she was great as well. I'd forgotten to mention to my wife Lynn that was the singer from the Cardigans. We totally shocked her actually because she wasn't expecting that. But he was very jovial and very chatty, and I liked it when he switched to electric guitar for a bit. That was good. Nice guitar he had as well. He had some keyboard problems at the start in Aberdeen, which was quite amusing how they got through that. But the band were super tight as well, actually, very good.
Yeah, I had a quick word with them after the gig and described them as smoking. Yes. And there was a nice kind of bit of space between the instruments as well, wasn't there? So, yeah. And everybody got their turn. Some nice guitar breaks from aforementioned Peter. And the sax player, Lena, was fantastic as well. I mean, she was there playing her second instrument, the flute, but it's obvious that she was a fantastic saxophone player.
There was one bit at the start where she did a saxophone solo, and I thought at the end she was going to pass out because she looked like she hadn't breathed for too long, and she really looked like she was a bit unsteady in her feet. But no, very good, actually, the whole band, I thought. So.
Yeah, and the other observation I would have is that they all looked like they were really enjoying themselves and each other's play, and that, you know, it just makes for a good gig when you see people up there having fun and enjoying themselves. After the gig, I was out in the, well, there was a merch stall there, and I was going to get one of the albums signed by James, and Nina Persson was there as well, so she signed the record. She was kind of frowning because she hadn't played on it. They'd run out of the stock of the Great White Sea Eagle, which has also been pretty popular.
All
so
right.
she signed the copy of the other one, but she was very down to earth. I mean, there was somebody else was talking to her. I didn't pester her or anything, but she did sign the record for me. And
I mean, are the Cardigans, are they still together? I don't know if they were.
I think they have done summer tours in recent years, playing outdoor gigs and the like. So,
yeah.
Yes, they're still going. I'm not sure if they're going to record anything else, but great voice, and there was a nice kind of combo of voices between herself and James York.
Yeah, and, yeah. No, I thought it was really good, actually. So.
Yeah, so thoroughly recommend that. We're hoping to have James on before too long. Once he's finished this part of the tour, he'll then be going off and doing his own thing with his own band, but we'll hopefully have him on before too long. Right, Terry, just to finish off, you've been to the movies and All Quiet on the Western Front. I take it was Far From Quiet, was it?
So this is, so this is based on, I'll just write it down here, actually, Eric Remarks, who was a German veteran of World War One. It's a story about, the trenches toward the sort of starts off to the early part of World War One, and it's going to skip through to the end, to the literally to the latter days of World War One, and it's as traumatic as you could possibly imagine. There's not much, I don't think there's any, is there any joy? The only bit where they steal a chicken or a duck, was it? That's the only bit of the film that's got a bit of joy in it. It's a fairly bleak, but as you'd expect, sort of story of a couple of pals who are all excited to go to war in the early days. And it's good to see it from the German side as well. And it goes right up to literally to the last day of the war. In fact, it was up right up to the last minute, I think, at one point, where I don't know, I assume this is fact, where it was 11 o'clock on the 11th of November, because it gives you the dates as you go through, so you know you're getting close to the 11th of November. And it was like 10:30 on that morning, where the German general, who looks a bit like sort of a Bond villain, sends him back into battle again to attack the sort of unsuspecting French right at the end, for no reason than his own ego, I think. So it's a fairly dramatic watch. It's certainly worth doing it. I mean, it's going to be up for a few Oscars, I believe, as well. Certainly foreign film. And hard to say I enjoyed it, but I mean, I did appreciate it. I mean, it was definitely worth watching, I think, if you get a chance to. So,
yeah.
And what was interesting, there was two threads to it. So there was one bit, which was the guys on the trenches. And then the second bit was the Germans negotiating the truce, which was in this sort of forest and a train on the train tracks. And there was two train tracks. One was the French and one was the German. So it was interesting, kind of the two kind of parallel stories going on at the same time to hopefully get to the same end, which they did eventually. But yeah.
Good. And the other movie you've been to see is Tar, which is pretty controversial stuff, I gather.
It was a bit of a... So Tar is Cate Blanchett, where she plays the kind of... conductor, I guess, of an orchestra. Obviously, a fairly very talented, very sort of, I can't think of the words, but Svengali possibly type person, who obviously inspires lots of people who want to be in her orchestra or be like her. And I said, it's the only film. The first 20 minutes, I almost left. So we sat in Aberdeen watching it. It was quite a long film, 2.5 hours. The first 20 minutes were so dull. It was a very dull start. And I said to my wife, I said, I'm not sure I can stick this to the end. But it was very subtle how it built it up. And it's got a whole backstory about this person who was, she'd obviously had a relationship with, who was in her orchestra. And it brings the story in very slowly. It's almost in the background, so it's sort of incidental. And then it becomes to the front. And then she's got an assistant. And it turns out, obviously, there's been some sort of abuse all the way through it. And this person commits suicide. And then they start to investigate and looking at that, and was she involved? And she obviously was. And she ends up, I mean, I thought at one point it was a true story, but no, it's great. Music was fantastic. Cate Blanchett learned how to conduct an orchestra. It's very good. She ends up in Japan, is it? Or Tokyo, or maybe China, doing kind of a strange, because no one would take her anywhere else. But it's worth, again, Oscar-winning performance, but certainly very enjoyable towards the end. And needless to say, I stayed right to the last minute. So.
Good.
So it was good. But yeah, I honestly thought the first 20 minutes is so dull. I'm just kind of not sure I could take this sort of thing. So
yeah, so patience pays.
And unfortunately, did you watch Happy Valley?
I haven't seen a single episode of it.
No, me neither, which is a shame because obviously lots of people at work have been watching Happy Valley, and I've been trying to not get spoilers so I can maybe go watch it on the BBC, and has failed miserably in that this week. Oh, so-and-so. I'm like, oh, shit. So I'm not sure how that'll be worth, mind you, so, but I'll maybe try and get into that at some point. But.
Good. Okay. Just before we go, Terry, it's not been a great year to start off with so many, would you say, rock legends passing away. We've had a couple of significant figures have gone in January, haven't we, with David Crosby and Jeff Beck.
Yeah, and of course you saw Jeff Beck last year. Did he look well?
He looked fine, yeah. He was, I'd say he's probably a pretty clean-living guy. Not like David Crosby, obviously, but no. But they both made their own mark, didn't they, really? I mean, you know, Beck kind of eschewed vocals so that he could make his guitar the voice of his music, didn't he? Whereas with Crosby, he was kind of a vocal explorer in terms of harmonizing with the likes of Graham Nash, and he did that to amazing effect, didn't he? I mean, not absolutely. Just with Crosby, Stills and Nash, but with the Byrds before that.
I quite like some of the Crosby, Stills and Nash and Young stuff, and I went back and listened to some of that, obviously, and read a lot about him, actually, as well. I mean, he wasn't particularly a pleasant person, I don't think, David Crosby. I mean, cast aspersions on someone who's passed away, but he certainly kind of knew what he wanted, I think. And, I think genius probably.
Well, we've got a lot to thank him for. I mean, he's, you know, arguably one of the first people to start developing psychedelic music. So he was responsible in part for that, and also for getting Joni Mitchell's career off the ground. So, you know, those two things, plus, you know, he did make some fantastic music, whether it was with the Byrds, with 8 Miles High, or obviously Marrakesh Express and all that kind of stuff with Crosby, Stills and Nash. Pissed off nearly everybody he played with, but hey-ho. And Jeff Beck, the polar opposite. Everybody loved him. His funeral sort of commemorative service was the other day, and everybody who's anybody was at that. Yeah. And not one of them appears to have a bad word to say about the guy. He seemed like a real gent.
That's good. One thing worth mentioning, obviously, this week was Ozzy Osbourne also decided to stop touring. And I saw a video of him this week as well. And I mean, he didn't look particularly well. He was getting out of a car and he was struggling to get out of the car, but it would have cheered him up because he managed to win the best rock album at the Grammys. God knows how.
Yeah.
Because that's not a great album. I know we didn't work on top of it, but do you know how many categories there were in the Grammys?
512?
Oh, no, 91. 91. And that's a ridiculous. There was one, I saw, because Stuart was laughing, best melodic rap album. Was one. Right. 91 categories. And I just thought, that's just ridiculous. I mean, that's just trying to please everybody. But Ozzy won the best rock performance, the best rock album. And I thought, well, fair play to him, I suppose. I think so. But
He's not the only Sabbath member who's been in the news this week. I was listening to the radio this morning. I heard Tony Iommi interviewed about a ballet that's going to be made around the music of Black Sabbath in Birmingham. So we'll maybe do a bit of investigation on that. See if we can get Tony on to talk about it.
Are you a ballet fan?
Not particularly.
No, I can't imagine. So is it a particular album or a song they're going to do it on? Or?
Well, I'm not sure, but Carlos Acosta, it'd be pretty well known. I think he's maybe a Cuban ballet dancer who would be well known. He's a big Sabbath fan, so apparently that's where the tie-in is. But so we'll have to do some more investigation, put on our tutus, and we'll be back with the next episode of Four Idle Hands before you know it.
Yep, I can see you in a tutu, Michael. That sounds good.
Till the next time.
See you soon.